Hi, welcome to Why, Philosophical Discussions about Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. Today we're talking with Stephen Darwall about the moral demands we make on others. So you're walking quickly down a secluded path on your way to work. You rarely take this shortcut, but you waited out the big rainstorm, and now you're late, very late, for an important meeting. As you turn the corner, you see a man pinned under a fallen tree. He's moaning in pain, and he sees you. "Help me," he says. "You need to lift this tree off of me. I can't do it myself." You can tell he's about to pass out. You can also tell this will take a while, be really hard for you to do, and you don't have a cell phone to call anyone. Your thoughts turn to work and the people waiting for you, knowing that if you miss this meeting, you'll lose your job. But the man under the tree catches your eye and seems to read your mind. He insists, "You have to help me." This is the point where philosophers typically ask you what you're going to do. Professors, advice columnists, clergy, they've made careers out of posing ethical quandaries that pit your immediate self-interest against the needs of others. Which is more important, helping this guy or keeping your job? That is not what we're going to ask today. Instead, we're going to ask a more subtle question, namely, what authority does this person have to tell you what to do? Notice what he said, "Help me." That's an order. "You need to lift this tree off of me." There's no room for dissent. "You have to help me. This is a command. You have to do this." And the thing is, it seems right that he's saying these things in this way. Regardless of what you decide to do, you don't think that this person is violating your rights by demanding assistance. You wouldn't respond by shouting, "You can't tell me what to do. You're not my father." That would be crazy. It'd be unhinged. It would be to completely misunderstand the situation. Where does this come from, this authority to boss other people around? And how is it you are accountable to a stranger's demands? If you went to work, told people the story, and explained that you were late because you helped him, if your clothes were dirty and torn from climbing under the tree to push it off of him with your legs only, the most callous of bosses wouldn't blame you. And if you said you didn't help him, well, no one would really respect you again. But imagine instead if you came back and reported not that someone told you to help him, but that someone asked for help. This is different. It's a scenario in which you have a choice, in which the situation might demand action, but a person doesn't. That is the subtle point here. In most ethical quandaries, we ask whether the circumstances require a certain kind of response. But in the story I laid out, it's the person, not the circumstance, who we have to answer to. In today's episode, we're going to examine the moral demands we make on others. We're going to ask what gives a person authority to expect things from other people, from demands for help to telling someone to stop stepping on your feet. This way of dealing with morality seems much more common than telling someone to obey a rule. Imagine how silly it would sound to say to someone, "Take your foot off of mine. The moral rule requires that you stop stepping on me." What rules? Whose rules? Why are the rules more important than the person whose foot it is? Citing rules inspires philosophical argument, but demanding action from others, that just feels more serious. To put all of this another way, when we command or are commanded, we are part of a relationship, whether we like it or not, and this relationship has moral power. We are part of a community and are expected to hold to the community's expectations, to what the people in it hold dear. Rules and law are valuable, of course, but more often than not, it is simply the people themselves we are concerned with. You don't want to step on my foot because you don't want to hurt me. I want to lift the tree off of you because I want you to be okay. Rules may describe this. They may report how countless people have and should have acted in countless circumstances, but it's the personal nature of the obligations that has the power. What all this means and why this is will be the topic of conversation for the next hour. I just want you to notice that when it comes to morality, we're no longer simply asking what to do in a difficult situation. We're now concerned with the power each of us has to get others to act. This, it turns out, is a radical shift. It's a whole new question. And now to our guest. Stephen Darwall is the Andrew Downey Orrick Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and the John Dewey Distinguished University Professor Emeritus at the University of Michigan. He's the author of numerous books, including his most recent one, The Second Person Standpoint. Steve, welcome to Why.
Well, thanks, Jack. It's a great pleasure to be here with you and with your listeners.
If you'd like to join the conversation, email a question at askwhy@und.edu or visit our chat room at whyradioshow.org. You can always post a question or comment on Facebook at facebook.com/whyradioshow. So, Steve, I want to start off by taking a step back a little bit. Philosophers spend countless hours and write thousands of pages about ethics every year. But for most of the world, the idea that one shouldn't murder someone or steal seems fairly straightforward. What's the problem? Why do philosophers have such a difficult time with ethics?
Well, that's a great question. I think actually all of us have a great problem with ethics. I mean, first, ethics is just central to all of our lives in ways that we probably don't appreciate. And I think actually we're a little double-minded about this in some ways. I mean, you say, what could be simpler than that it's wrong to kill people? Well, indeed, what could be simpler? But I think all of us, when we think, well, what actually makes it wrong to kill someone? That is, what makes it true that it's wrong? That's where the really interesting philosophical problems come. And when I say we're all a little double-minded about this, I mean that I think many of us, once we pose that question to ourselves, find ourselves fleeing into something like some form of relativism or subjectivism or some version of the idea that morality is somehow created, let's say, by God's command or something like that. Or we stand behind the view and think, well, no, I think it's actually true that it's wrong to kill people, and there must be something that makes it true. And that's the hard problem. That's the really hard problem. What does make it true? That's the sort of thing I've been thinking about, you know, all of my 40 years, I guess, in teaching and thinking about philosophy.
But there's also, right, a whole other set of questions. I mean, if my reader was to pick up your book or other philosophers' books, especially in the last 50, 60 years, there'd be all of these subtle distinctions, including this distinction between belief and the will of what we know and what we actually do. Why are these differences, why are these subtle distinctions so important to philosophers?
Well, you alluded to one reason in your introduction. So think of the difference between thinking of morality or moral demands as something that come somehow from principles or from rules, from norms, on the one hand, or thinking that in some way they don't just come from principles or norms. They come from each of us, and not just from people, but from other animals or maybe from nature. And that's an important difference, I think. I mean, I could go into, for example, why I think it's important in the central case that you mentioned, but it's that kind of difference that matters.
Aren't philosophers, I mean, for thousands of years, concerned with this sort of a version of you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, right? From Plato and Aristotle onward has this been this character question, right? You can know what's right and wrong. Lots of people know it's wrong to commit adultery, but lots of people commit adultery anyway. Lots of people know it's wrong to steal, and they steal anyway. And we're not talking about, right, the people who think it's okay to download MP3s, right? We're talking about the people who know it's wrong but do it anyway. So how do philosophers talk about the motivation to act as distinct from the beliefs that they act on?
Right. Well, I think one of the things that's really most interesting about ethics and about morality in particular is this idea that somehow there's got to be some connection between really holding an ethical view and being disposed to act on it. And a version of that, you know, has been in the philosophical tradition since Socrates. I mean, Socrates famously thought that you couldn't know the good and fail to act on it. Now, that seems counterintuitive, but there's something deeply right about it. And, you know, that doesn't really answer your question of where the motivation comes from. I think we're learning a lot more through empirical psychology and neurophysiology about the way actual human beings function and the way moral thought and ethical thought in general is situated in our brains, in our central nervous systems, and in our psychology and sociology.
Is the will, is this notion of self-motivation, is this a philosophical idea or is it a psychological idea? I mean, I know that's sort of a stupid distinction, right? Because originally it was all the same thing. But when philosophers now look to the question of what motivates people to act ethically on what they know, do they look, as you're suggesting, primarily to psychology and empirical stuff? Or is there still a philosophical conversation about what moves someone forward?
Well, the question of why people do what they do is a psychological question. That's not really a question. I mean, philosophers are intensely interested in it, but philosophers don't really have anything as philosophers to offer on that question. That's a question of empirical psychology. But there are these concepts, like the will, for example, that play an inelimitable role in the way we see things, and the nature of the will is really, in the end, I think, a philosophical proposition. And then we ask how exactly it's situated in human psychology. Well, that's an empirical question.
Suppose someone said something along the lines of, look, if people believe what's right, they're going to act. And if they don't act, it's because we haven't given them the right reasons. Really, it's about the nature of the justification, which is a whole other discussion of ethics, right? Justification for ethics. How important is this? Is this a viable position that really it's not about the principle that we put forth, but the justification behind it?
Right. Well, I think one of the things that's true about ethics is that if it's true, let's say, that it's wrong to kill innocent people, then that must be true by virtue of there being certain reasons that make it wrong to kill innocent people. There must be reasons against killing innocent people. So truths in ethics and truths about morality in particular are, we might say, hostage to reasons. They're there only if the relevant reasons are there. And so when you say there's got to be some connection between the reasons that make it true, let's say, that it's wrong to kill innocent people, that people would then have, yeah, that just seems right.
I ask these questions in part to prepare everyone who's listening for the next question, which is to ask you what you mean by the second person standpoint, because this phrase, which you've written an entire book about and many things leading up to that book, incorporates all of these different issues, right? Incorporates the will, it incorporates the truth, it incorporates the reasons, it incorporates all of this stuff, yet it's a very small phrase. So what is the second person standpoint, and why is it an important step forward, at least in your mind,
right,
in ethics?
Right. So go back to the example that you were talking about, that is where you were walking along and you come upon someone whose a tree has fallen on. And that person catches your eye and asks you, or I guess you had him ordering me, but you could think of it either as an order or you could think of it as a plea for help. Think about it the latter way for the moment. Now, there's, of course, the objective situation that you're presented with. There's someone who's in need, and unless you help them, they will be in a bad way. Maybe they'll die. Who knows? And those are important reasons for you to help that person. But there's also the further reason, which actually in this case may not loom quite as large as the person's need, and that is that the person has asked you to help them. Now, in other situations, that reason looms very large, even much larger. Somebody just asks you for directions, let's say. Well, there may be certain reasons why you should or shouldn't give them directions. It's hard to think of any reason why you shouldn't give them directions. But it seems like the fact that they've asked you is a further reason. And the point is that if it's a reason, then we must have some standing to create reasons for one another by the way we engage one another. By asking, by requesting, by demanding in some cases. And it's the distinctive character of those reasons as situated in this relationship that we bear to every other person, even if we haven't actually related with them. That's the second personal standpoint. It's the standpoint that we can be thrown into the moment someone says, hey, or help. And once we are in that perspective, it's what Buber called the I-Thou perspective, then we're just seeing things differently, and we see reasons that wouldn't have occurred to us if we were just looking at the situation from an observer's perspective.
When I first encountered this idea, I had a lot of trouble just sort of intuiting what you meant. And what helped me was to remind myself what this notion of second person means, right? When we write in the first person, we're writing from the perspective of a character. I went down the street. I ate a burger, right? When we write in the third person, we're talking, he did this or she did that. We're distinct. It is very hard for writers to write in the second person. And the most famous example of this recently is Bright Lights, Big City, where the author says, you are walking down the street. You're in the city. And when I wrote the narrative, I wrote it in the second person because choose your own adventure books are all in the second person, because what you're doing as the reader is entering into that second person. And the reason why that was so important for me when I was trying to grasp what you meant by second person standpoint is this notion of addressing someone else, that when you make an ethical plea or a moral demand on someone, you are entering into their perspective in a certain sense. You need to help them. You are creating something for them to acknowledge your existence. And so you're sort of, I don't know, messing with their agency a little bit. How serious do we take this second person perspective? How seriously do we take the imposition of an idea, a narrative, a story on the person that you're addressing?
Well, I think we take it very seriously indeed. So one way to get into this idea is to imagine certain kinds of emotions that we frequently feel. Suppose someone cuts you off. Let's say you're driving on the highway and someone cuts you off and you feel resentment. Resentment is an example of what the philosopher P.F. Strawson called a reactive attitude. You're feeling it towards that person, and the way you might give voice to it is, hey, you can't do that. It's not just, oh, that was a bad thing that just happened. There'll be some sense that you're in a position to address that person in a certain way, and that they have some obligation, as it were, almost to listen. I mean, I think it's a very interesting and important fact that when people wrong us or when we wrong others, the natural expression, suppose we're in the position of being wronged, what we want is for the other person to take ownership of what they've done, to acknowledge to us what they've done. There's a reason why apology can be a kind of response to wrongdoing. Apology is in its nature second personal. There's no such thing as an unaddressed apology. So it's about this relationship, and I think it's just, you know, it runs throughout human life.
Later on in the show, I want to ask you where this moral obligation comes from, what creates it. But before then, because again we're dealing with something really subtle and a difficult shift, I want to ask you to sort of explain to the audience, what is this problem? What problem does this solve? What does the second person standpoint give us that you think may not have been either present or a dominant idea before you started talking about it?
Right. I think it is crucial both for us to understand the nature of morality, that morality is essentially about what we are accountable to one another, and to ourselves as moral persons for doing. That's the first thing. And the second thing is I think it provides the best hope of grounding or justifying morality, so understood. And I think earlier other attempts to understand the nature of morality have sometimes missed that ineliminable element, and other attempts to ground morality have failed because they haven't been able to ground that essential element.
So we're making a shift to what philosophers call metaethics. We're not talking about the content of the rules. You should do this. You shouldn't do that. This is what it means to be nice. Rather, we're talking about where the rules get their power, where the demands get that power, what morality is, in the same way we might ask what science is or what biology is or even right. What a car is, that we're trying to define and explain a subject area. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
And then I go back to the original question, which is, is this philosopher's making a mountain out of a molehill? I mean, is aren't there lots of people, if you asked a person off the street, wouldn't they just say, yeah, morality is doing the right thing, and you do the right thing because either that's how you were raised or that's what God told you to do? Why is it important to have a discussion about what morality itself is?
Yeah. Well, I think one way you can see this is by thinking about the phenomenon of moral disagreement. Now, I think that we in our society have lost a little bit of a former ability we might have had to talk about these things in public together. I'd say over the last 15, 20 years, increasingly, I've found people, and maybe myself in certain moods, who, when faced with certain kinds of moral disagreement, find it very easy just to say, oh, well, what you think is right for you and what I think is right for me. A kind of relativism, I call it the relativism of avoidance, because it's an easy way of avoiding what might otherwise be an awkward conversation. But I think most people really don't believe that relativism. I think they actually think that their views are true. And the question is, what makes them true? What does make them true? And I think the point is that we're actually all invested in the truth of our moral convictions. And what I'm saying is that the best hope of grounding, of finding something that could be a justification for moral convictions, is to be found in the second person standpoint.
So where traditionally some people might say, what makes it true? God declared it. Or what makes it true? The logical arguments behind it. Or what makes it true? It is better for everybody. What you're saying is, in fact, what makes it true is not these things, but rather something about the nature of our relationship and what we can demand of someone else. There's something about who we are when we take this second person point of view, when we say you to someone, that makes it true in a way that perhaps the divine or the purely rational isn't as convincing. There's something about the psychological perspective that provides us with an answer that these other things can't.
Yeah, I mean, the idea is that we all the time use these concepts, and we feel these attitudes, and we have these emotional responses to one another, to their actions, to our own actions in certain situations. And these responses and these thoughts have this, what I call, second personal aspect to them. We don't really avoid these feelings. I've yet to find anybody, when I've talked about these kinds of ideas, who is immune to these kinds of thoughts and feelings. But the point is that to have these thoughts just is to be in a second person standpoint. It's to be in a position where we are seeing others as potential yous, and we're seeing ourselves as a potential you as well. And then the thought is, what I argue in the book is that there are presuppositions of, or if you like, assumptions, necessary assumptions of viewing others in this way and viewing ourselves in this way. And I make an argument that morality, understood in a certain way, is an essential assumption of the second person standpoint.
When we come back, we're going to follow through with that essential assumption, and we're going to talk a little bit about what it means to be held morally accountable. You're listening to Why? Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Stephen Darwall about the moral demands we make on others, and we'll be back after this.
The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life bridges the gap between academic philosophy and the general public. Its mission is to cultivate discussion between philosophy professionals and others who have an interest in the subject, regardless of experience or credentials. Visit us on the web at philosophyandpubliclife.org. The Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, because there is no ivory tower.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We're talking with Stephen Darwell about the moral demands we make on others and his book, The Second Person Standpoint. If you'd like to participate in the conversation, email us at askwhy@und.edu. That's askwhy@und.edu, or go to whyradioshow.org to participate in our chat room. You know, I, like many of my friends, have been reading and posting a lot of political stuff on Facebook lately. Mm-hmm. And a couple days ago, a friend of mine posted this message, this long sort of two or three paragraphs that talked about, you know, all of these people who disagreed with her point of view, you just have to understand she's excited and she's enthusiastic, and she wrote all these comments during the most recent debate. And for her, it's like sports, and they should just relax and let it flow past them, and that they can all be, you know, friends afterwards. And I, both reactively, as Steve said earlier, but also in that desire to incite that I sometimes have, responded by saying, you know, you're saying that people are peeved. You know, what's wrong? What's worse, people being peeved that you're excited about democracy, or your opponents wanting to take away your rights? And I'm not going to say which side she was on or I was on or anything like that. But, you know, and she wrote back and she said, wow, Jack, you're right. Boom. You know, like it was some sort of slam. But the thing about Facebook is that it becomes really easy to forget that we're talking to people. And it also becomes really easy to forget that we're talking about real things, and that an election, because the media treats it like sport, we treat it like sport, and we forget that the consequences are all too real for many, many people. I'm not a big fan of the term virtual world, because I think what happens in Facebook really affects people. At the same time, that virtuality makes us forget that the people who are reading and the people who are writing are real people. They're whole people, and they react positively and negatively. And so we do things online that we would never do in public, that we would never do in a group. And there's something about that protective shell that takes away the true nature of the relationship, sometimes for the better, but often for the worse. And so I guess I'm transitioning into this question for Steve about the nature of what it means to address a person. Can you dress a person the way that you address a Facebook status or a post or a tweet or a blog? Is there something essentially different? Because Steve, as you well know, and if our leaders were to, if our leaders, that was Freudian, if our audience were to open any recent book on ethics or political philosophy, even for the last 200 years, they would be focused on this notion of personhood, of dignity, of respect. Why are these terms important, and why are they essentially human terms as opposed to terms about how we interact with someone, say, in the virtual world?
Yeah. Well, let's take your example. It's a very interesting one. And let me take a slightly different example first. That is commenting, let's say, on a website or on a post on a blog or something like that, but not attributed to yourself, just making a comment. That seems to me to be even more anonymous, and to take out of the equation more the kind of accountability element. Posting on Facebook, there are different – I mean, there are messages to particular people through Facebook. There are postings to one's friends. A lot of posting, of course, is a matter of self-presentation. Which isn't really second personal at all. It's, hey, look at this. Either because it's interesting or because it's something about me that you'd like people to see or whatever. That's, in my terms, third personal rather than second personal. Why is it that philosophers have, in the last 30 years, have been interested in dignity and these kinds of questions, respect, the value of persons? I think it started, frankly, at least in my lifetime, with the civil rights movement in the 60s, and then various other kinds of liberation movements that came out of that, that got philosophers thinking about the underlying philosophical ideas that were really at stake in that important social and political moment of our national life. And it was the idea that to be a person is to have certain fundamental rights. It's to have a dignity. And then philosophers really tried to grapple with that idea. Of course, you could look back to Kant's groundwork of the Metaphysics of Morals, published in the 18th century, which probably is as important a philosophical text about the dignity of persons. And not surprisingly, that's when Kant's moral philosophy started to be of much greater interest to philosophers, starting back in the 1960s.
So part of what's happening is we're rebelling against this notion that was at one point enshrined in our in the American Constitution, that a black person would count as three-fifths of a man, that there is no such thing as being a human and counting as three-fifths of a person, that to be a human is to be a whole person. And what a whole person means is to be worthy of respect and worthy of dignity and worthy of treatment that something like Facebook sometimes hides. You also say in the process that being a person, that one of the consequences of being a person, this is a mouthful, this phrase, is to be a self-originating source of valid claims. Now, what does that mean and how is that connected to this notion of being a whole person worthy of dignity and respect?
Right. Well, the phrase is from the great American political philosopher John Rawls, whose great book, A Theory of Justice, was published in 1971. The phrase, though, comes from a lecture he gave in 1980. I won't try to give you the title. It's pretty abstract. Here's the idea. It's a very simple idea. Go back to the example at the beginning of the show, not the one where you encounter someone who has a tree on top of them, but someone steps on your foot. One feeling you might well have if someone steps on your foot is, hey, you can't do that to me. What you give voice to when you have that feeling is the thought that you have a right not to have your feet stepped on. But what is a right not to have your feet stepped on? Well, it's not just that there's a good reason for other people not to step on your feet. It's that you're in a position to demand that people not step on your feet, or actually to allow them to step on your feet if there's some purpose that they might achieve by doing so, and you're prepared to allow them to do that. Or if they do step on your feet, to ask for an apology. The victim of a rights violation has a kind of authority or standing to demand an apology that nobody else does. The victim can decide, for example, in our law courts, to decide to bring a tort action in a way that nobody else can. Whether to punish someone for violating a crime isn't a matter for the victim. That's a question for the people. But whether someone should give compensation, well, that's an issue for the victim. All of these ideas involve the thought that the victim has a distinctive standing to demand certain things of the person who victimized her or him. So the thought there is that each of us has, by virtue of having certain rights, this kind of authority to hold others accountable to us in particular. But that just means that we ourselves, as everyone else, is a source of claims. So we have a kind of standing to claim certain things from others. That's what that mouthful means. And it's Rawls's mouthful, not mine, but I think it's a pretty good mouthful. I think it's complex, it's complicated, but it says exactly what's true.
So because I am a whole person and I count as a whole person with this dignity and this respect, if someone wrongs me in some way, I can say you can't do that solely by virtue of the fact that I'm a whole person and that I don't need any other justification. I don't need to be the divine property, as John Locke might have said, or I don't need to be more important than someone else. The very fact that I am a person means that if someone violates my rights, I'm allowed to make a claim against them. I'm allowed to say you can't do that simply because I am my own person.
Exactly. And maybe we'd also could put it in the other way around. That is that the fact that others are persons means that we can't treat them in certain ways. And were we to do so, we should apologize to them. We shouldn't just think, oh, I'll be better in the future or something like that. We owe it to them. So it's the idea that each of us has this same standing, and everybody has it. Every person has it.
So it's a reciprocal relationship. Everything that I give on some level I receive, and everything I receive I give, because everyone has this equal standing and everyone is equally a person.
Right. In fact, it's not just a reciprocal relation. It is the reciprocal relation. It's the idea of reciprocal relations. That's the whole point.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is it's not just that someone else might respond to you in a certain way or you might respond to them in some way. It's that we are in the position of reciprocating one another. You might think of the golden rule as the fundamental idea of reciprocity. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. So if you're prepared to make a demand of others, then you must be prepared to make the same demand of yourself in relation to others. And the point is that this is a relation of reciprocity that each owes to everyone.
Is this an extension of what I'll call the tradition of empathy, right? When we're young, and there are many philosophers who pull this thread as well, when we're young and we're learning what it means to treat others a certain way, we say, we our parents tell us or we tell our kids that, you know, imagine what you would do if you were in their situation. Imagine how you would feel if it was your foot being stepped on. Imagine how you would feel if it was your teddy bear being taken or played with or what have you. You want to share because you don't want them to feel left out. How much of this is an empathetic response in that you would feel the same way if you were them? And how much of it is this more abstract personhood that is independent of what you feel for your fellow person?
Right. So empathy, as I understand it, there are various things that are meant by empathy. One thing might be what's psychologists sometimes call emotional contagion. That is just catching other people's states of mind, their emotions, their attitudes, or they're catching ours. I think what you mean and what I would mean by it is a slightly different idea. It's the ability to put ourselves in others' shoes and to imagine the situation from their perspective, from their point of view. Empathy in that sense is utterly central to the second personal relation. You cannot be in a second personal relation with someone without empathizing with them in some way. In fact, you have to even to understand them as responding to you. So when you are in a relation, I to you, you have to be able to see yourself as a you to that person as well. Otherwise, you can't even interpret what they're saying. And empathy is just part of that process.
So let's go back then to the original sort of discussion of the phrase the second person standpoint. Because we're talking about addressing other people, because we're saying you to someone, we're saying you can't do this, you shouldn't do this, etc. We can't address anyone unless we understand that they are in some sense the same as us, that when we talk about you, we are imagining their point of view as if we could enter their point of view. And in return, that means that what we're really doing is not only empathizing with their emotions, but empathizing with their very existence, that their right. existence is as real as our existence is.
Right. That's the point.
That's very abstract, but it's really, really important in the sense that, right, I mean, go back to the 3/5 of a man kind of thing. It seems that much of the debate of human history is the debate about whether other people count as people.
Right. And one way I like to think about this in historical terms is it's easy to keep other people at bay so long as you just look upon them or look at them. When you look to them, when you engage them, and therefore they engage you, then that changes the frame. And the frame is changed in such a way that you can't help but empathize with them, because you to be in that perspective is to be seeing yourself reflected back through their eyes.
And there's, of course, a long tradition, even religious, of playing with this idea, from Abraham to welcoming the strangers at his tent pole, to Jesus washing the feet of people and wandering around the people who are outcasts, right? These are all figures who have tried to acknowledge the personhood of other people by talking about the sameness.
Absolutely. I just mentioned one painting. You mentioned Jesus. There's a painting called The Tribute Money by Bernardo Strozzi. It shows Jesus confronting the Pharisees when they're trying to, as Mark says in the Gospel, catch Jesus out. And Jesus, this is the famous scene in the Bible where Jesus ends up saying, render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, render unto God the things that are God's. But there's a point where just before Jesus delivers that line, you know, he says, you know, bring me a Roman coin. The moment I'm interested in that's depicted in that painting is the moment just before that when Jesus says, why tempt ye me? So that's obviously addressing the Pharisees. He looks right at the Pharisees and says, why tempt ye me? And they don't look back at him. They look at one another. And for me, that's the difference between Jesus trying to hold accountable someone, or in the examples you gave, Jesus holding himself accountable, let's say, to the weak and the unwashed and ministering to them. That's the difference between a second personal engagement and some way of being in somebody else's space that doesn't really acknowledge them.
And this is interesting because this also explains why it is a person and not some sort of divine aspect, because when Jesus is out in the desert being tempted by Satan, he can't say to Satan, why tempt me? Right? Because we know that's just what Satan does, and there's no reciprocal relationship at that point.
Right.
I want to move on because we only have a few minutes
get
left.
Get thee behind me, Satan.
That's right. That's right. That's a way of acknowledging
yeah.
someone, right? Putting them right. behind so you can't see
right.
them.
Exactly.
Right? I hope our audience can see how complicated the debate is, but how these technical aspects really do highlight examples and situations that they're all very, very familiar with, and gives us a vocabulary to talk about it in a way that is satisfying and communicable, not only to Christians who follow a particular interpretation of Jesus or Jews who follow and Muslims who follow a particular interpretation of Abraham, but a whole community of people who can share this terminology and these ideas and apply them to different examples.
Right, right.
And that's why I think it's really interesting that you end up talking quite a bit about membership in a moral community. And you make a distinction between the civil versus the criminal case. And what you say basically is, in a civil case, a person who's suing someone in a civil court gets to decide for themselves whether they're going to sue. And it's Jack versus Steve.
Right.
But in a criminal case, it's the people versus O.J. Simpson, or the people versus someone else.
Right.
And talk to us a little bit about how moral communities and moral authority is in some sense larger than an individual person, even though it is centered around an individual person.
Right. So there's a subtle philosophical distinction here between the idea of a wrong and the idea of someone having been wronged, that is, a wronging of someone. The civil courts in the law of torts are about wrongings. And when we feel as if we've been injured, injury is the technical legal term. It's a moral term as well. Of course, it can have a meaning for us in physical terms, but in a way, the self's been injured. Then it feels as though the person who's been injured has some claim to compensation from the person who harmed or injured her. Okay, so in that case, it's her standing to demand or to demand an apology or demand compensation, or alternatively, to forgive. That's also her distinctive standing. And she's not speaking for the moral community when she does that. She's just speaking for herself. She's holding another person accountable to her in particular. But in other cases, in the idea of not just wronging someone, but doing wrong, the thought here is that we're accountable, even if we're not accountable to anyone in particular. Even if there's no particular person who's been wronged, there's still an element of accountability. And it's, who is it to? Well, it's to the moral community, or to anyone as a representative member of the moral community.
Now, I want to interrupt for a second because we have a question from Joyce, and she asks, suppose one comes from a culture that does not believe in equality for all individuals, and they honestly believe that they're correct, that it's a caste system or something like that.
Right, right.
To a certain extent, relying on the moral community helps solve this problem, right?
Well, I don't know if it solves it. It frames it. So part of what we believe in believing that everyone is equal is that we believe there is a moral community, where the moral community isn't, you know, any actual community of people around here or anywhere in particular. It's the idea of all persons. This is not an idea that's been accepted in all of human history, and it's not even accepted now all over the globe. But that doesn't mean that it's not true. So if a culture doesn't accept it, then, you know, I think that culture is, in that respect, missing something important.
I want to go back to this notion of reasons and the role that reasons play. Are reasons... Actually, let me take a step back, because what I was going to ask, so you can think about it, is, are reasons necessary for accountability? But we haven't really addressed explicitly what it means to be accountable. What does it mean to be morally accountable? And what does it mean to have a moral obligation? And if that comes from this acknowledgement of other personhood, then where is the enforcement mechanism? You cite Mill at one point, right, where you say Mill said that in order that we wouldn't call anything wrong unless we think it should be punished, right? So if moral authority comes from the person, where does moral accountability come from, and how do we force that accountability?
Right. Well, my view is that all these ideas are what I would call a package deal. They come together. There's no way you can have the notion of authority without the notion of accountability. There's no way you can have the notion of accountability without the notion of authority. And there are other ideas that come along as well, the idea of a legitimate demand, a justified demand, and also the idea of a distinctive kind of reason for acting, the reason that I call a second personal reason. So let's go to your question of what is accountability. Start with this thought that we began the broadcast, that if someone's stepping on your foot, then you have, pardon the pun, the standing or the authority to demand that they get off. And if they don't, to hold them accountable. Okay, so the thought is that in having a right that other people not step on our feet, we have the authority to demand that they not. But we also have the authority to hold them accountable to us. What is it to hold someone accountable? Well, I think it's, in effect, to demand that they hold themselves accountable to us for having acted in the way that they did. So the deep point is there's simply no way, it's just unintelligible to hold someone accountable for something without implicitly inviting them at least, perhaps even demanding, that they hold themselves accountable to us. What does that involve? Well, it involves, for example, considering the question of whether they did, in fact, what we say they did. And if they did, to acknowledge that, to own up to it. And if they did, and perhaps they had some excuse, saying what that was. So it's being in a position of justifying ourselves to others. And the idea is that if we're all fundamentally accountable to one another, we're all in a position where we owe one another justifications. In theory, of course, I don't mean in practice that everybody has this authority to go up and sort of demand of others by, you know, scolding them or wagging their finger in their faces. But the idea is that there's a kind of in principle accountability that's always there.
And this goes back to Kant. This goes back to Rawls. This is this notion that what it means to be a moral person is to be motivated by reason and be motivated by reasons. And so there's something inherent in this tradition that says that there should be something satisfying for human beings when we hear the reasons and the explanations. And in the end, we might not agree with them, but there's something about argument. There's something about rationality. There's something about justifications that speaks to who we are as human beings. I understand that it's a theoretical point, but is that a model of human identity, of human motivation that is suitable for the modern world?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I think it's actually increasingly suitable to the modern world, because I think what is happening in our current, it's been happening over human history, is an increasing acceptance of the idea of human rights, for example. It's a very important aspect of my lifetime, surely. When I was first born, I'm a baby boomer born just after the Second World War. Just after that was when the UN Declaration of Human Rights was promulgated. And it wasn't instantly signed on to by every country. But these days, there is no country in the world that doesn't at least superficially accept the idea of human rights. So we're increasingly, I think, viewing other human beings as beings to whom we owe some kind of justification. There's another important point here, which has to do with the kind of reasons. Of course, there are lots of questions about how to lead our lives that we don't presume any kind of authority to make demands of one another on. It's the distinctive kind of reasons that are in play when we hold one another accountable. So the idea that we're rational beings, that's part of what's involved here. But the thought is that we are not just any old rational being. We're a rational being who can enter into relations with one another. We're, as it were, second personal rational beings. And that's what makes us accountable to one another. And that's what brings into play the distinctive kind of reasons, what I call second personal reasons, that are involved in the idea of moral obligations and obligations to one another and human rights and so on.
I want to push this a little bit because, perhaps unfairly, I have in my head this example. In late Middle Ages in the Iberian Peninsula was one of the periods of, for lack of a better term, we'll call it pluralism, when Jews, Muslims, and Christians lived together. But one of the ways that some of the communities were structured is that any time a Christian wanted to, he or she could demand entrance into a Jew's house, and the Jew would have to listen to them witness, and they'd have to listen to them try to convert the Jew to Christianity. The Jew didn't have to convert, but they had to put up with the attempt. That was part of the legal framework. And it's not the kind of pluralism that we think of, but it's certainly better than being massacred, right?
Right.
To a certain extent, that feels like an example of having to listen to other people's reasons, right? And having to,
right.
You know, and it's not necessarily reciprocal, but there's a perversion there
right.
of what you're saying. So I guess the
right.
question I'm asking you is, how does your idea not devolve into that kind of distortion?
Right. Well, I think you pretty much said it. So it's a one way. It's not. So the situation you're describing is where one party owed the other a listening, but the other didn't owe the first a listening. Okay, so that's a perversion. That's a distortion. That's a corruption of the idea of accountability. And I think it was possible for people of that time to maintain that notion only if they accepted certain other, I think we would think, illusory or fantastic views about what the authority to listen to others is based on.
So to a certain extent, I mean, it hangs on two different concepts, one which is, I suppose, a little easier than the other. The easier one is this notion that reciprocity is an essential part of the theory, and without reciprocity, it falls apart, or it distorts. The second is this notion that at the core of your theory is a notion of some certain truths, and one of these truths is Joyce, our listener asked earlier, is that we regard all people as equal, and that without this, we have to be committed to some sort of notion of universal personhood. Otherwise, it's just not a persuasive theory for the modern world.
Right. But there's a further point that really is important, and that is that the reciprocity or the equality, it's not just an assumption we make. It's something that emerges necessarily from the second person standpoint. So take the situation of the Christians in the late Middle Ages in Spain, as you're describing them, who think they have the authority to demand that Jews in their city listen while they try to convert them. Okay. Now, if they think they have that authority, they must think that the Jews are accountable to them for listening, so that if a Jew didn't listen, then he would have wronged the Christian. The Christian would have some standing to hold him accountable. But now notice the following thing. In order for the Christian to think that the Jew is accountable to him for listening, he's got to think that the Jew can hold himself accountable to the Christian for listening. So what that means is not just that Jews should defer to the Christian or allow them to talk. It's that they're accountable for listening. But they could be accountable only if they can hold themselves accountable. And they can hold themselves accountable only if they have a certain kind of standing that they share with the Christian. So this actually takes a little bit more time and space to develop properly. But I would argue and have argued in my work that, yes, reciprocity is essential. But not just as a moral assumption, it turns out to be an essential presupposition of the standpoint that the Christians were already assuming in relation to the Jews in the late Middle Ages, as corrupt as it was.
I mean, it sounds like, and this is not going to be a surprise to you, I know, but it reminds me of Adam Smith, right? Adam Smith, when he's talking about the development of tenants' rights, and he says that the lords of the land wanted to guarantee that the serfs stayed on the lands. They had a guaranteed income, so they invented this notion of a lease, and they forced the serfs to sign the lease. But by forcing the serfs to sign the lease, the serfs were guaranteed place on the land. And so in their self-interest of acknowledging what they wanted, they had to acknowledge the serf's right as a contractee, and that changes everything.
Exactly. That's exactly the point.
Which leads actually—
Once you have the idea of a contract, then you have the idea that both parties have a certain kind of freedom to accept or not to accept the contract. Now, in this case, they were being forced to sign it. But there are certain ideas of the parties as equals in respect of contract.
So this actually leads to a question we had on Facebook from Caitlin, who asks specifically what happens when our obligations are contractual. She thinks that there might be loopholes and then asks what certainly is the libertarian question, right? Are we morally obligated to keep promises? What if doing so requires dishonest activities? So, I mean, let me translate her question to ask, and I know you spend a fair amount of time at the end of the book talking about contractualism, although that's not exactly what she means.
Right.
If we start thinking about people as parties in a contract, then can't they define the relationship in such a way that it doesn't acknowledge the personhood? Is the whole personhood necessary in all exchanges? Let me take away that last sentence. Can people set up a contract to create loopholes that will move around what you're trying to say?
Right. So it's true that actual contracts between actual persons can create new obligations and new rights, but they can do so only if it's true already that the parties to the contract already had certain obligations and had certain rights. So that's a deep point, I think, about the nature of what is sometimes called a normative power, the power of contract. But there are certain things you can't do through contract, because there are certain kinds of contracts that don't have any, obviously, in the law, legal standing, but more importantly for us, moral standing. So an important kind of example that philosophers have talked about since at least the time of Locke was whether someone could contract himself into slavery.
That's exactly what I was thinking about.
Yeah. And Locke thought not, and Rousseau thought not. And I thought Rousseau gave really the classic reason why not. You could contract yourself into slavery only if you could divest yourself of your responsibilities as a moral agent. Now, this sounds in a way ludicrous to us because, well, we think of slavery as being a pretty awful condition, and it is a pretty awful condition. But it's also a condition in which one is no longer an agent. One is one's own agent. One is an agent of the master. And Rousseau said, well, you can't morally sell yourself into that situation because that would be to divest yourself of your moral agency, and nobody has the moral power to do that. And I think that's right. So even though contracts can create new rights and new obligations and release others from obligations they would otherwise have, we can't ever release one another or ourselves from our fundamental obligations to one another. And those don't come from any actual contract.
And this is a very deep point, and we should spend a little bit of time on this because it helps explain a bunch of things, right? What you're basically saying is moral obligations are inescapable.
Right.
And you can't take away certain aspects of what you are required to do morally. Fascism promised its people that, look, if you abide by the government, then you're not responsible for what the government does. The appeal of fascism is abdicating all responsibility. But of course, what we now know in looking at the period of time when fascism was so growing, is that we still hold them accountable.
Right.
And that this is, if our readers are interested in a discussion like this, there's a wonderful book by Daniel Goldhagen,
right,
called Hitler's Willing Executioners, and then there are people who respond to him about how responsible the ordinary German citizen was for Nazi Germany and the Holocaust and things like that. And so what we want to say is virtually exactly what you're saying, which is – it doesn't matter if they say you're not morally responsible. You are still morally responsible, and there is no way to abdicate that moral responsibility. Now, why is that? Is it just by virtue of our humanness?
Yes. but let me say a little bit about the example you give, because it's such a wonderful example. The Nuremberg trials, of course, established as a matter of international law that as a legal proposition, nobody could divest himself or herself of the responsibility of being a person just by virtue of saying, I was ordered to do this. But what they established as a legal proposition, of course, presupposed something they also believed, which is that as a moral proposition, you can't, no one can, divest him or herself of one's fundamental moral personhood. What does it have to do with, you know, you ask, well, is it just because we're human beings? Well, I think it's a distinctive aspect of our human nature. I don't think it has anything to do with our biology, per se. I mean, we can think of humanity as a kind of biological notion. I don't think there's anything biological about it. It has to do with our capacity to enter into this standpoint, to enter into this kind of relationship with one another. And the thought is, anybody who has that capacity is, just by virtue of that, responsible to others, and in a position to hold others responsible.
If you accept those positions, then liberal equality, liberalism as we understand it, as the individual is prior to the community, this government must remain neutral, this sort of notion for our listeners that, you know, our government, whether Republican or Democrat, is a liberal democracy, right? This notion of liberalism, which comes first, I guess, is what I'm going to ask you. This sort of notion of the full personhood and then a liberal theory follows from that, or does liberal theory end up resulting in the realization that we are all individuals?
Yeah. Well, if this is a question about the history of ideas, how do these ideas develop? I think, in fact, they developed in tandem. I think they are essentially linked ideas. And it's probably true that those people in the early modern period, one thinks of Locke, for example, but then in the 18th century later, with the doctrine of human rights, the Declaration of Human Rights. These are, in the first instance, political moves. They're moves in a set of ideas having to do with the justification of the state and of a just state. But, of course, they are based in moral ideas. And I think just as a matter of human history, the two went together.
Then I want to ask one last question, and it's going to scream out for a psychological answer, but I want you to resist that urge.
Okay.
If we are in a circumstance in which there's something inherent in our experience, second personhood, the second person standpoint, and there's some sort of acknowledgement of the other, the way that Buber talks about it. Why all the vitriol? Why all the hate? Why is it so easy to divide the moral community, the individuals? Why is there this, what seems like inevitable, essential human characteristic? Smith calls it the love to domineer. Where does this divisiveness come from if the very act of acknowledging other people contains not only the content, but the justification and the motivation for ethical activity?
Yeah. Well, that's a very complicated question, and I'm probably not the best person to try to answer it. What I can say, though, is, well, so two things. One is that there are sources in our psychology that lead us to want to distinguish ourselves from others, to divide ourselves into groups, and then when we're in those divided groups, to see those in the other group as not just different from us, but worse than us in certain respects, or not really having the same standing that we do. I do think, though, that once these ideas start to come onto the stage in human history during the period we're talking about, they shape human experience in a way that both makes it possible for there to be forms of inhumanity that are really quite new and disturbing. I'm thinking of chattel slavery, for example. So you always had slavery in various forms throughout human history. But once the idea that every person has equal rights starts to take hold, then if you're going to dominate people in certain ways, you have to start to think of them as not really human. Not just that they're not Spartans or they're not Athenians or not member of your group, but you're starting to see them as not really human. And that then makes it possible for you to have ways of thinking about how you're treating them and actually to treat them in ways that are more horrific than other forms we had before. So these concepts, I think in the march of human history, if there is such a thing, lead in the right direction. And I think, you know, we're now in a situation where the idea that all human beings have certain fundamental rights has a kind of legitimacy that it didn't have even 40 years ago. But it's also true that certain human motivations to distinguish groups and to see groups as different and as worse and so on, they can be given a kind of scope in this new framework that can be quite disturbing.
James Lowen, he was also a guest on our show a few months ago, in Lies My Teacher Told Me, argues that you don't see any literature about the subhuman nature of the African until after the slave trade begins, that the African is considered exotic and different, but that the diaries of Columbus and other people, only after they start enslaving people do they start considering them inhuman.
Right.
And I think that brings up your point. So I said that was the last question, but I lied. I have one other question, which is, does this mean
that's wrong, Jack. That's a joke.
Okay. So you think Jim is wrong?
No, I'm saying that you're wrong to.
I see. Oh, I get it. Right.
It was a real joke. Sorry.
Oh, I see. That's okay. I know this is
philosophy.
I was thinking so hard.
Jim is entirely right. I think that's exactly the point I was making. Yeah.
Well, so now I acknowledge your humanity and apologize for lying about the question and for missing the joke because it was funny.
Sure, apology.
So to a certain extent, what you're saying is that there is an inherently educative function in the second point standpoint, because I'm very interested in the concept of political education and educating people toward citizenship and all this kind of stuff. And what you're suggesting is that inherently adopting the second point standpoint is pedagogical. It's educative that we learn by doing it.
Right. I think it is no accident that Socrates, you know, to whom we look for the origin of our great tradition in philosophy, was engaged in dialogue. Philosophy, as Socrates taught us to practice it, is essentially second personal. But the point is the same the other way around. To be in a second personal relationship to another is to make yourself open to the other as someone from whom you have something to learn and not just someone who should be listening to you.
That is a wonderful place to end. Steve, thank you so much for joining us on Why.
Well, thanks, Jack. This has been very, very interesting for me. I've learned a lot.
Thank you. You've been listening to Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. We've been talking with Steve Darwall. I will be back with some final thoughts after this.
Visit IPPL's blog, PQED, Philosophical Questions Every Day, for more philosophical discussions of everyday life. Comment on the entries and share your points of view with an ever-growing community of professional and amateur philosophers. You can access the blog and view more information on our schedule, our broadcasts, and the Why Radio Store at www.philosophyandpubliclife.org.
You're back with Why Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. I'm your host, Jack Russell Weinstein. We've been talking with Stephen Darwall from Yale University about the second person standpoint. And the last thing that he said in response to a listener question was, although there have been societies and there are still societies that don't believe that human beings are equally valuable, that are equally whole human beings, it doesn't mean it's not true. And that's where we started from. And that's the ultimate problem of a contemporary individualistic ethic that believes that all human beings have equal dignity. The problem is when we face someone who doesn't think that's acceptable, who thinks it's okay to kill a 14-year-old girl who wants to go to school, or who thinks that it's okay to enslave a group of people because of the color of their skin or their gender or their sexuality or something like that, all we do is get into disagreements. And then we can point to texts and point to traditions and point to parents. And there may be a point where there's no further to go. What do philosophers do in response? Philosophers engage in what's called meta-ethics. Philosophers step outside and ask, before we can decide what ethics actually says, we have to decide what ethics actually is. Before we decide what we have to obey, we have to decide how ethics works. Now, this is hard, and it's hard because it's abstract, and it's also hard because it's complicated and involves all these technical details. But we do meta-ethics all the time when we're parents because we say this one thing that I as a parent have said and makes me cringe. It's because I said so, right? My daughter does something and I'm tired and I don't feel like explaining it. And she says, why? Because I said so. Now, there's two ways to interpret that. One way is I am the authority and she has to listen to what I'm saying and I'm a lot bigger than her, at least for now. And so she has to do because I said so. But because I said so is also a model of a different kind of acknowledgement that she is going to have to learn throughout her whole life. And that is because I said something, it is worth attending to. Because I said something, it is worth considering. And the I is not just me. The I is everybody that she meets. When she encounters any person in the world, what they say is worth considering simply because they as a human being said it. It doesn't mean they're going to be right. It doesn't mean she is entitled to be harassed. It doesn't mean that people can't back away from her. But it does mean that her central personhood is involved in their central personhood. And when they say you, they have to acknowledge her. And when she says you, she has to acknowledge them. Because I said so is not just about the authority. It's about the I and who we are. As always, thank you for listening. It's been an honor to be with you. You've been listening to Why. I'll see you next month.
Why is funded by the Institute for Philosophy and Public Life, Prairie Public Broadcasting, and the University of North Dakota's College of Arts and Sciences and Division of Research and Economic Development. Skip Wood is our studio engineer. The music is written and performed by Mark Weinstein and can be found on his album Lua y Sol. For more of his music, visit jazzfluteweinstein.com or myspace.com/Mark Weinstein. Philosophy is everywhere you make it, and we hope we've inspired you with our discussion today. Remember, as we say at the Institute, there is no ivory tower.